You're listening to the Round Table Podcast, Episode 1.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robison.
And you're listening to the Round Table Podcast.
Each week on the Round Table Podcast, Brian and I invite writers to come onto the show and present their story ideas to Brian and myself and our esteemed guest host.
And then we dig into it, talking about what works and what doesn't, kick around some ideas, and try to fine-tune it into a solid and writable story.
Yes. And this, dear friend Brian, is our premiere episode.
I'm excited.
I am pumped. I have butterflies in my stomach. Oh, my God. Doubly so because our esteemed guest host for our premiere episode, we couldn't be more delighted, is J. Daniel Sawyer. Dan, thank you so much for being on our first podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. And if you have butterflies in your stomach, stop eating caterpillars.
Oh, God. See, already I'm getting good advice that I can carry with me into my life. Awesome. Dan, I mentioned in our episode zero that you were one of my first podcast experiences with Down from 10. And I recently, in following you on Twitter, discovered that you have an incredibly busy first quarter planned for 2012.
Yep. Are you wanting me to recap what's going on?
Yeah, what are you rocking on the Dan Sawyer keyboard these days?
Okay, well, I've got 7 short stories, a novel, and a nonfiction book that are finished and that'll be released in the next few weeks. The novel is book 4 of the Clark Lantham Mysteries, in which Clark Lantham has to unravel an apparent alien abduction in full view of security cameras and the theft of a Chinese artifact from a museum in San Francisco.
So it's a light puff piece then.
it's that weird blend of dark and humor that is part and parcel to those books. I have so much fun writing those, though they drive me crazy because the plots get so twisty. The nonfiction book is called Throwing Lead, A Writer's Guide to Firearms and Shooters.
Is this something you have a lot of experience with?
Yeah, I discovered that I kept getting asked by other writers things about guns. That I'm not a gun nut, but I've had a lot of family in the military and grandfathers who were ranchers, so I've grown up with them as part of the background. And so I kept getting the same questions a lot, questions people would never ask if they had just been around people who own guns, let alone shot them or anything. So I realized that there's a market for this. We've got this whole generation of writers who've more or less grown up in cities who see guns in this sort of heavily symbolic light, either through the filter of their personal politics or through the filter of movies, both of which are equally wrong.
Right.
Wrong in the sense of being disconnected from reality.
Sure.
And that there was really a need for a book for writers that, in a non-political way, goes through the history of small arms, the way the technology works, lots of pictures and diagrams, the psychological aspects of people who deal with weapons as a matter of their job or as a matter of their life, people like farmers and security guards and cops and criminals and that sort of thing. And to do this all in one book that'll sort of lay enough of a groundwork that anyone then going to do their own research will have the vocabulary to understand what they're reading.
That sounds like a valuable resource.
So that's coming out soon too.
Okay. And is that going to be hardbound or is that going to be digital?
Digital first, then paperback, probably a month later. That's
awesome.
About how I normally rock it with the books.
Okay. Ping us when it's out. We'll throw it up on your showcase page on the website.
Will do.
The Lantham books, going back to that series, now, how many of those books do you have?
Silent Victor will be book number 4, and I had originally planned 5, but now I'm planning 9.
Ah, yes.
Running across great ideas.
But, will that ever stop?
What I'll probably wind up doing is end the series, but then sort of go back and fill in gaps between stories when I feel the need to. Because I do like having closed arcs and that sort of thing. But yeah, book 1 was And Then She Was Gone. Book 2 is A Ghostly Christmas Present. Book 3 is Smoke Rings. Book 4, coming out soon, is Silent Victor. And then Book 5, He Ain't Heavy. Book 6, Extinction Tango. Book 7, Behind the Hypnotic Toad. And Book 8, which I haven't titled yet, but is about asteroid mining, are all pretty well planned out.
You're also in the studio, aren't you, recording some podcasts, some audio fiction?
Yeah, I've got 7 audiobooks to record between now and Memorial Day.
Ooh, dude.
I'm between novel writing spurts, so I've been breaking out scripts for books. I'm 3 books into the 4 books I need to break out so far. And starting next week, I'm going to be recording 5,000 to 10,000 words a day as just part of my normal daily work routine.
Outstanding. And I think I speak for most of the podosphere when we're saying we can't wait. That's going to be awesome.
It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been a while.
Speaking of which, you made a really good point on your blog when you were talking about having to produce continually produce things so that you have items available for your audience to go out and and take a look at. And I think that's something that maybe should be talked about a little bit.
Okay. Do you have a more concrete question, or do you want me to just wax?
Oh, God, ask him a question, please.
Feel free.
Oh, Brian, what have you done?
Well, okay, so I learned this one the hard way. I wrote Predestination and then podcast it, and then intended to, once I was finished with the podcast, start writing again, which I did, but I did not... I got to the end of this book that made this huge splash. I wound up, I think 8 or 10,000 people listened to it so far all the way through. And I've got reams of feedback. I was able to fill 10 hours of feedback shows, just responding to listener questions and having conversations about issues that interested them in the books. And I had nothing to follow it up with. I had nothing for sale. I had nothing to feed the monkey that I had produced. And I basically found myself, in effect, starting over from 0 with Down from 10 as far as momentum goes. There's this unspoken agreement that creative people make with their audience, which is that I'll give you something so good that you love it, and then I'll give you another one afterwards until you're satisfied. The whole idea about just leave them wanting more is only a good idea if you've got something else coming.
If you've got more.
Right. If not, they're either going to hate you or they're going to forget you. And both of those are very bad for business.
And can happen rather quickly, I assume.
And can happen really quickly. So what I learned from that is, A, never, and then the subsequent experience with Free Will a year and a half later, never podcast something that you're not finished with. And the second one is never give away everything that you've done, particularly if you're wanting to make a living doing this. And it is... if you want to make a living doing this, it is a real full-time profession. I work about 80 hours a week. I love every minute of it, but I work 80 hours a week between writing and managing legal stuff and recording and doing photography and all the related things that feed into the studio here. I work 8 hours a week. It is more than a full-time job, and at the moment, it pays less than minimum wage, but that's okay because this is a long tail business. You build up a stable of products, and they each pay you in streams of nickels, and you get enough streams of nickels, it adds up to a very comfortable living in the long term.
Awesome. So your plate's full for the next 4 months, 3 months,
decade. For the rest of life. I've got a very solid beat on what happens over the next 6 months, a rough outline of what happens the 6 months after that, and then every 6 months I sit down and sort of flesh out the 6 months after that. So I've discovered for me that is the optimum balance between, oh my God, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm coming apart at the seams. Once I'm finished with this, my creative life is dead. And, oh my God, there's so much to do, I'll never finish it. I may as well shoot myself right now. We've bought different tolerances for both of those, and finding the optimal tolerance for you is very important.
So anticipate bipolar, manic depressive syndrome if you pursue this lifestyle.
Well, it's like so much else in life, it's... when you take your life into your hands, when you take your career into your hands, rather than following a preordained path that fits you well enough that you're happy with it, when you're forced to do all that work for yourself that everyone normally gets done for them, you learn a lot of things about the way that you work internally. Some of it's practical stuff, like I, for example, do my best work writing-wise between 3 and 6 in the afternoon and 2 and 4 in the morning. So I structure my day around that. I go to sleep at 4 or 5 in the morning and I wake up at noon, and then the rest of my day is built around the biological schedule that is most convenient for what I do. Then there's deep emotional stuff. We've all got hang-ups and ideas about the way things should be that may fit most people but do not fit us, and they hamstring our ability to work effectively and enjoy ourselves. And when you do life as a freelance in any business, you are continually forced to confront both sorts of hang-ups.
How do you get around that? How do you deal with that?
You learn to adapt to what you are instead of trying to be what the image of should be that you inherited from whatever culture you grew up in is.
Now that's sage advice for anybody, not just a writer or someone in the creative industry.
It's Aldous Huxley? No, I can't remember who it was. It was an economist or a science fiction writer or someone who said in the middle of the 20th century that if you want to change man, don't change the man, change the environment. Humanity is the animal that adapts. We don't adapt to environments. We adapt the environment to suit us. And if you carry that down to a personal level, you find that life is much more productive and fulfilling than if you're continually trying to adapt yourself to environments that you're not suited for.
That makes good sense. And on that note, let's go ahead and cut out for a short promotional break. And when we get back, let's fine tune this laser discussion towards a story and see if we can't create some literary gold. Sound good?
Cool.
Awesome. All right.
Let's do it.
We'll be right back.
My name is Justin McCumber. I'm the creator and one of the co-hosts for the Dead Robots Society podcast. Every week we discuss a variety of topics that are fundamental to the craft of writing, from the differences between tone and theme, to world building, to how to create compelling antagonists. Along with the roundtable discussions, we've also had the pleasure of interviewing published authors, television writers, podcast luminaries, publishing house founders, and magazine editors. We're dedicated to our listeners, and we work hard to pack our episodes with as much quality education and entertainment as possible. We never stop encouraging ourselves and our listeners to always be writing and to always be improving. The promised land of publication is our goal, and we know that together we can achieve it. If we can also have a good laugh along the way, all the better. You can find us online at www.deadrobotssociety.com. At our website, you'll find show notes, links to our personal sites, our email address, and direct download links to our episodes. You'll also find a link to our forums, where we've created a private critique group so that you can safely post your work and get comments and suggestions from us as well as our listeners. All we ask is that you participate by critiquing in return. So come to our site, subscribe to our show, and join us. You can also find us at iTunes. Just search for Dead Robots and we'll be there. After that, get writing. We are.
Okay, we're back in the studio, on the line with Dan Sawyer and Brian Humphrey, and it's now time to introduce our guest writer. This fine young gentleman is someone I've actually spent some time with on the writing board that we both share, and he's proven himself to be a not only a gifted writer, but an incredibly dynamic individual. Benjamin Claiborne, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dave. It is great to be here.
All right. Ben, let's go ahead and move into this next segment. Tell us a little bit about yourself, first and foremost. Roughly where you're at, what do you do, what brought you to the show?
Well, where I'm at is I would consider myself, you know, a new author, a starting author. Writing is something I've always enjoyed doing, but only in the past year have I really gotten to the place where I felt that I could make it a career. And so ever since last summer in July, I've just really realized that this is what I want to do. And it was sort of like a switch was flipped in my brain where one day I just sort of decided, you know, this is really what I want to do with my life. I don't want to be 80 years old and looking back and thinking, geez, I really wish I had, you know, gone down the path of being a writer, and I didn't. So that's that sort of seemed to trigger it. And ever since then, I've been writing pretty much continuously. You know, I've got a day job and I've got a family, and, you know, it's, you know, it's a juggle, but, I think that I'm dedicated to getting there, and, with a lot of hard work and a lot of help from fabulous friends like Dave, I think I am going to get there. So I'm glad to be here and get some help from somebody who seems like he's, got much the same goal that I do, but is much, much farther along.
And that's the whole objective of the Roundtable Podcast. Excellent segue. That's good. You read from the script. That was fabulous. let's go ahead and do that. Let's dive into this. Benjamin, go ahead and give us your pitch. Try and keep it to 5 minutes, but I understand with the creative juices flowing, you may deviate, but try and keep to that. And then we'll start asking some questions and dig into it.
Well, as you told me the other day, I am quite a talker, so I will try to keep myself rambling incoherently for hours on end.
Oh, boy, you and me on the same call. We're going to take 4 hours here.
Yeah, this is going to be four episodes.
It's a good thing I've got a long cigar here.
Isn't the first episode of everything supposed to be a couple hours long anyway?
I think so, yeah. And
that,
you know,
works. It's a pilot episode, right?
That's yes,
right.
Yes, it has to be longer to incorporate all of that rich character depth that is going to define this thing as an epic piece of podcast history. Yeah, okay. All right, Ben, the mic is all yours, my friend.
All right, so here we go. So over the years, I've accumulated a bunch of random ideas, you know, and the particular idea that I am bringing today, one thing I've always really liked is the traditional classic hero's journey story, where you've got the young, naive character who is introduced to this much larger world that he had no idea really existed. And he goes about, you know, finding his destiny and, you know, discovering his power and confronting adversity. This story, this idea is a very traditional hero's journey. It doesn't really have a title. I put in a working title when I was sending the info to Dave. But the idea is, the genre would be fantasy, traditional epic fantasy. The idea is that it starts off with a young, naive hero. Let me give you the log line first. So the logline would go like this. A young woman in a fantasy kingdom discovers that she has the power of mages and must fight an unholy army to secure peace for the realm. So like I said, very traditional story, you know, starts off. The idea is that we have this young girl named Dana, and she grows up on a farm out in the countryside, sort of this idyllic childhood where her parents are farmers and there's the nearby town, and she just grows up, you know, the traditional childhood. But there's hints of sort of other background elements that are revealed sort of at the beginning. You know, her father has sort of a mysterious past that they don't really talk about. There's, you know, occasional mentions of this sort of mysterious evil force off in the distance that, you know, the grown-ups talk about in hushed tones when the children aren't around. And this girl grows up to be sort of a, you know, spunky young woman, and she's very outgoing, energetic and excitable, headstrong, you know, really wants to know what's going on, doesn't like being in the dark. I'm not a big fan of the girl who doesn't fit in, the tomboy who isn't like the other girls. I don't really have a problem with a character who has that internal conflict of, you know, she likes the femininity. She likes wearing frilly dresses and going to dances and flirting with boys, but she also likes going on adventures. You know, she doesn't just like, you know, playing with dolls. She also likes playing with swords. So that's sort of how I envision that character to start with. And so as she grows up a little bit, and while she's in her adolescence, her teenage years, the evil army invades her realm. And this is the, you know, there's sort of been this shadow lurking on the horizon. and the evil army invades your realm. And everyone's biting their nails and everyone's worried, oh, what are we going to do? And the grown-ups are all like, well, you know, we'll send off to the king for help. And, you know, the evil army ends up on the path towards her town, and her town ends up getting damaged, destroyed. There's a battle nearby or in her town. And Dana ends up having to leave the town, getting thrust into the world. So she goes out into the world in the company of some adventurers. She falls in with a couple of knights or a small adventuring party that is somehow related to the war or the battle. And it's around this time that she discovers, or somebody discovers, or it is discovered that she has the ability to use and control magic in some way. So so she goes along with this group of adventurers, and she's developing, she's learning, you know, who she really is and how she fares under real adversity. You know, and as she's going along, she's starting to grow in her powers, and she and her band of adventurers are trying to help stop the evil overlord of the army. And as they're going along, the evil overlord starts paying attention to them because they start being a thorn in his side. They start thwarting some of his minor plans. And he begins to want to know what the deal is with them, and sort of, you know, something that a lot of evil overlords frequently want to do, which is corrupt the good for their own uses. At the same time, he is not the only antagonist. And the other antagonist that I thought of, and someone who I find, you know, the kind of character I actually find more interesting, is a renegade mage, a woman named Surya, who is one of these characters who's very sort of not all there, a little bit mad, a little bit unpredictable, has her own goals, but isn't operating from the same frame as everyone else. You know, the evil overlord is very rational, and he approaches things from a very logical perspective of he wants power and he's going to do things in the least risky way in order to get them. And the heroes on the other side are also very rational, and they want to get, you know, achieve their goals. They know what their goals are, and their goals are clear, and they're sort of at odds with each other. And because of that, the good guys and the bad guys can, to some degree, predict how the other will react to certain things. This other character, this renegade mage, is someone who you can know all of the same things that she knows, and she will still do something literally random that seems completely mad. In fact, it may be completely mad, and she may not actually get closer to what she wants by doing it, but she does it anyway because she's crazy. So this character is someone who starts out on the same side with the evil overlord. They start out in cahoots, working with each other. And he sort of makes use of her as a, you know, this rogue element to help go out and, you know, do particularly heinous things that he doesn't want to deal with. And then as the story goes on, they eventually break apart because she essentially gets too nuts. And he, being a very rational evil overlord, tries to kill her. He either fails or thinks he succeeded and failed. And she escapes and goes off and begins being the sort of third force, this third actor in the whole drama of what's going on. And wreaks havoc sort of randomly and throws everyone's plans into disarray because she's just so unpredictable.
I'm going to interrupt you for just a second.
See, I told you I was a rambler.
You are a rambler. Holy crap, dude. let's talk about the story and the story as it's been presented so far and ask some questions. Dan, what are your first impressions of Benjamin's story?
So my first impression is that you actually, with all that time, you didn't tell me a thing about your story. You listed out the tropes and archetypes you're going to use. You basically told me Lord of the Rings meets Star Wars in, you know, with a female protagonist. It's not that can't work, but there's nothing in what you said that tells me anything about why the story is special to you, or what it sounds like you have not quite yet found the core of the story you're telling.
I agree that that's true.
So I suppose I have one suggestion and a bunch of provocative questions.
Yes.
My one suggestion is that you pick up a book called The Sociopath Next Door and read it. The last several chapters are crap, but the first several chapters are very good because they provide illustrative examples of how highly manipulative evil works. inflected in different personality types and that sort of thing. I think that will really help you with your bad guys.
Okay. The sociopath next door?
The sociopath next door.
Gotcha.
Questions I have are, have you thought about or worked out the politics and the economics of your world? That'll be the first one. Have you thought about the politics and economics of your world?
No. The way I usually, when I'm approaching a story, is it usually starts from some element like that, where I just think of a particular thing like that. Like I said, that scene that I described was something I just sort of envisioned while I was sitting around, standing around.
Mm-hmm.
From there, I sort of do a very iterative approach to building the actual final product, which is... doing some exploratory writing, seeing where the characters go, then going back and thinking, okay, let me think about the actual formal structure of the story, doing more drafts, thinking about, and then interspersed in here is actual world building, working out the, the political and economic and sociological implications of whatever it is.
So, Dan, why do you feel that that fleshing out the political and economic structure is relevant to this?
Because the political and economic structure defines the incentive scheme for your characters. Lord of the Rings uses pre-Viking feudalism as its baseline political and economic structure, and it crosses that with the English village system, which is what you see in the Shire. And having the pre-Viking feudal system crash in on the little English village system is what creates the conflict that drives the plot in Lord of the Rings. The reason that I think it's important to work that out, particularly when you're doing medieval type fantasy, is that it's really, really easy to accidentally stick 21st century characters in 12th century clothes. And without noticing it as a writer. And I'm speaking as someone who did this with their first two books that will never see the light of day. And it creates in the reader a sense of falseness that is very hard to get past. And the reader won't usually be able to articulate why they don't buy it.
Yeah.
But it's one of those hidden things that the reader can see more easily than the writer can. And the other question I've got for you is, have you considered, when you're discussing the conflict between the good guys and the big bad guy, not the chaotic bad guy, you're describing something very like the Cold War. And in the Cold War, that worked because the Westerners and the Russian bloc shared a basic set of incentives. There's a cultural baseline before the two sides of the Cold War diverged, so that the Westerners could fairly easily read the mind of the Soviets, and the Soviets could fairly easily read the minds of the Westerners.
Yeah, they both knew what the other side wanted.
Right, they both knew what the other side wanted. What I didn't hear in what you said was any way to account for or deal with imperfect knowledge. Because it's when the good guys guess wrong or the bad guys guess wrong, and the reasons for the guess being wrong, that's where you can start to work some of your own voice in and make it really special.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit in this particular story idea?
Well, let's... I'll go by analogy to Lord of the Rings, because... it sounds quite a lot like that. In Lord of the Rings, Sauron makes wrong guesses about the hobbits, but not about the elves or the men. And the reason he makes wrong guesses about the hobbits is if you read the Silmarillion, Sauron came to power fighting elves and men first by apprenticing under them. So he understood their culture from the bottom. And he knew how to play them against each other and how to play his forces against them in the most effective way. But he didn't understand the hobbits at all. He didn't understand the ethic of the farmer and the tradesman, who is okay with just working at a task because it needs to be done, and whose loyalties rest with friends rather than with governments. And that's how the hobbits were able to fuck up Sauron's plan. If it hadn't been for that, the men had no chance against him, because he knew how to tempt and corrupt them. And the elves had no chance against him because all his magic was elvish magic. But the hobbits were this wild card for this very subtle reason, and that's why he didn't understand them. It's also why the hobbits didn't understand him. But the hobbits had guidance from elves and men to teach them how to understand Sauron, and so they were able to sneak in around the cracks.
Okay. Does that give you something to play with, do you think?
It does. Yeah. It does. I mean, like I said, this is an idea that I haven't, you know, it should be obvious from the way that I described it. It hasn't been developed very much.
Brian, did you have any questions or observations you wanted to offer to Benjamin?
Absolutely. And a lot of it has to do with maybe in a much more simplistic way, some of the things that Dan was talking about. One of the things that I wanted to know is what is in your log line, you know, you're talking about Dana must fight an unholy army to secure peace for the realm. But what is it that is driving her specifically? What is it that she wants? You know, and you talk about she's forced to leave her village. Is it a series of things that happen to her, or a series of things that take place that she makes happen? And that makes a really big difference between, you know, whether your audience gets behind her or not. If it's just a bunch of things that are happening to her out of circumstance versus, you know, her putting herself in situations, whether knowingly or unwittingly, or, you know, making bad choices, and that's what's bringing a lot of things about. So that was one thing. And then another thing that kind of stood out to me had to do with a villain. And, you know, when you talk about how he is evil, and it sounds like you're placing him in the almost Conan-esque pure sense of the word evil. Yeah, where it's, you know, I it's all power hungry. I want to take over the world, and everything that I do is going to be based on raising my power and on, you know, destruction of everything else until every person bows to me. And there's a very subtle power that is given to, you know, your antagonists when they actually believe in what they're doing in terms of it being the best thing for everyone. That kind of arrogance that I am the best thing for everyone.
Right.
And that, you know, being misled in that particular direction to where if they believe it and we believe that they believe it, you know, we almost have a kind of sympathy for that, and it complicates things. And, you know, the more complicated it is, the better, I think. So.
Yeah, no, I actually completely agree with that approach.
And I think it almost makes him more dangerous, you know, to have him believe, as opposed to, I just want power. It's, you know, everything that I am doing, there's a purpose behind it, and I'm doing it for your benefit, and you can't see that, and if you stand in my way, I'm going to get rid of you.
As you're writing for an American audience, there's a subtle twist on that's good to keep in mind. Americans are inherently suspicious of power. We don't like it in general. The idea that someone is out for power is enough to make us hate them. It's a really productive part of American culture. It keeps ossified power structures from forming so far, which is good. But the danger to the writer in that is that it's very easy to create bad guys that are caricatures that people will go along with and nod and enjoy, but then they'll leave the story and they won't carry anything of that with them.
Yeah, they don't have the character.
Right. Whereas if there's something about the bad guy that is humanizing, that is discomforting, that can make people hear in that bad guy an uncanny echo of something in themselves, yeah. that will make the bad guy and the moral thrust of your story, if you've got one, stick with more of your readers.
Which sort of goes back to what we discussed previously about an archetype. Taking that archetype of that villain, and then generating some kind of element of irreconcilable self, something that is counterintuitive to the just base evil.
So I wanted to invoke something that I think can give us a lot of juice in terms of these discussions, and that is the mighty what if. And this is a privilege that I think all hosts and guest writers should be able to invoke, the what if this, Just as a suggestion, as an alternative perspective on what's been presented so far, it's fair play and can be dismissed out of hand, absolutely, but I'm certainly going to invoke it right now, because I can. The notion of the evil lord, what if instead of power, one of the things that I like is the sympathetic villain. I really enjoy the conflict of having a writer lead me to a point where I go, oh crap, I kind of see where he's coming from. You know,
like Straczynski did with the shadows in Babylon 5.
Yes, exactly, where they almost become sympathetic villains. So what if, you know, you've dressed this evil warlord and all the tropes and signals of the archetypal evil guy, but then what if he's desperate? What if his life is imperiled? What if his race has died out, and he recently discovered a way to bring them back? And I'm just spitballing here. I'm not saying any of this is worth a damn, but finding some sort of goad that drives your evil villain, and a goad that's justifiable enough where you can almost say, wow, you know, if I had his power and that goad, I might be walking the same path.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
I like that in general, or more to the point, in general, I have no problem with it. I don't think it's right for every story. For this story, because the story is you know, in the very beginning stages of even being developed, it could totally work. I think that if you're trying to establish a sort of a compare and contrast between the protagonist and the antagonist, then that might be a better approach, because that way you can say, you know, well, I like the protagonist because they're fighting for honor and justice and family, but I like the antagonist because he's also trying to right something that he perceives as wrong, and he's got his own struggle.
Well, and I think that's very much what Dan was alluding to when he spoke earlier about, you know, haven't told us about the story yet, is those underpinnings, that matrix that you lay the protagonist against the antagonist, and have determined, why is it that this particular protagonist is perfect for this antagonist and vice versa? What are the qualities that make up that character, those characters rather, that make this conflict so explosive and so relentless and so inevitable that these two people must, at the end of the story, come into conflict in some way, shape, or form?
That is a good way to approach it.
So, and I wanted to... Go ahead.
I was going to say, if I can come in orthogonally, and that sparked another set of questions in my head. It's unusual to have a female protagonist in a hero's journey, which is cool, but it does mean that you might have to do a little bit of extra work in figuring out, because it's a coming of age story, what does it mean for a woman to come of age in this culture, and what does it mean in that case for a man to come of age in this culture as well? How are they different? How are they the same? The hero's journey, as classically conceived, works because it's against a feudal background where a man has to be a warrior and a hero to get respect in his community. And everybody understood that when the hero's journey was sort of distilled in the Greek and medieval eras.
Dan, can I interrupt for just a second?
Yeah.
When you speak of the hero's journey, are you talking about the Campbellian hero's journey or the literature hero's journey?
Talking about the one Campbell distilled down from all the different old myths.
All right.
So that's it, and the structure of it is really good, but the content of it has to change according to the cultures and whatnot. But if you're doing a coming of age story, usually there's a few qualities of your main character that you either intentionally or unintentionally wind up focusing down on as the points of maturity, where they're immature at the beginning and how they need to mature over the course of the story. I don't know if you've figured out what those are, but if you do, that will ripple out into the rest of the story and answer a lot of these other questions. How is she immature, and how is she going to grow up? The other thing I'd want to mention is that archetypal stories are the easiest to do, and they're the hardest to do right. It's just like jazz is the easiest music to play and the hardest to play well. Because you're working on inflecting existing forms, it's very easy to write a carbon copy or a pastiche of all the ones you've read before without really intending to. And it's very difficult to take the forms and then fill them with content that comes from another direction, you know, that comes out of you particularly rather than out of the stuff that you've read and seen.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that I don't have to spend too much time getting that out of my system before I can get to the get to the good parts.
And there's no shame in writing a bad one and then just putting it on the shelf. Sometimes that's what it takes to get it out of your system.
Yeah. Sure. As writers, you know, aspiring writers, of which I am one, and Brian and Benjamin, I think we have to swim in those tropes for a little bit. We have to, like you say, get it out of your system in order to understand those tropes. Nathan made an observation during a discussion that you have to beat up against those tropes and work with them in their classic sense in order to understand them, so that when you achieve your voice, you can use them as a tool, not as a stopping point.
And I think there needs to be a cautionary point that one of the things that when Dan was talking about the coming of age of women and how that would look in Ben's story, when you're developing a mythos, and Dan, maybe you can sort of put this in a better way, but you can't eliminate all of the elements that people are comfortable with in our current culture when you're creating a whole new mythos. Would you agree with that?
I would almost agree with that. There is a way to do it. A person who does it really well is Gail Carriger. Gail Carriger writes these books set in Victorian England, and they have implicit in them all the racism, sexism, and all the ugly parts that were really part of Victorian England. But she constrains the viewpoint to the characters that are the social outliers, who are rubbing right up against and breaking those rules, and who are conscious of the fact that they're rubbing up against and breaking those rules. So all of them share some of the prejudices, but none of them share all of them. And that allows her to tell stories that a 21st century audience can access without putting 21st century people in 19th century clothing.
Right, right.
Excellent. I wanted to touch on the renegade mage character for just a second. Ben, when you were pitching the idea of Surya and the mad character, you said that she was actually more interesting to you than the evil lord in the antagonist category, and also that she's utterly random. Two things.
Not utterly random.
But random enough that people go, "What the fuck?"
Yeah, exactly.
One observation and one talking point. If this character is more interesting to you than the evil lord, you might consider making this a story about her as the primary antagonist. Just a suggestion. The other observation is that insane people are not random. They may appear random, but that's only because we, as quote-unquote sane people, don't understand where they're coming from.
If we were sane, we wouldn't be writers.
Sane. Good point. So we have one foot in the insanity door, basically. And I wanted to ask you, you know, have you thought about A, why she is insane, and B, and very specifically, what is the nature of her insanity and what are her goals? Because she's got to have goals. And if she's going to be a meaningful character in your story, she can't just be, God forbid I invoke this name, Fizbin, who just randomly comes along and does some weird shit and then wanders off and everybody goes, what was that? No offense to the Fizbin franchise, but it was something that for me, pointed out that this is a fairy tale.
Oh, and there was actually a story about Fizbin? I just remember the Star Trek card game.
It's this whole D&D Forgotten Realms franchise. So, But regardless, it was a character who came in, was very random, came off as kind of a lunatic on the good guy's side. So Benjamin, what is it about that insane character that captures your attention so much and makes her so appealing to you?
I'm not really sure exactly, and that's something I should probably work on too. But I think in general it's because the character like this is someone who is rootless, who, you know, home doesn't mean anything to them. Home is wherever they are right now, and not because they're sort of Henry David Thoreau wandering in the wilderness kind of, you know, enjoy life kind of person, but because they don't necessarily have any sense of permanence. And so because of that, they are someone who can, at a moment's notice, do something that seems completely random to everyone else, and it's them doing something random is totally normal.
Let me ask you this. Was she born insane, or was she driven insane? Is it biochemical, or...
I prefer characters who mentally at least, start out normal and are driven abnormal. And, you know, everybody's abnormal. You know, we're all abnormal. We all start out a blank slate, more or less, and then...
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Couldn't disagree more.
Okay, not all of it. There are some people who start out with you know, neurochemical problems, and they've got... That's all
this
separate.
This is going to devolve into an ontological discussion of the nature of humanity, but... Good point.
But without getting into neurology and deep psychology, if I could sort of hijack for a second.
Please.
And point out that when you've got an insane character, the thing that you have to remember about insanity is that, and this is actually true about people in general, is people are not rational, but they are always reasonable. They act out, even if they don't understand what their own driving compulsions are, they act in response to a chorus of voices in their heads and a chorus of biological drives that they've got going on and external incentives. And they're every person is navigating this complex thing every day when they go shopping, when they drive, that sort of thing. The difference with an insane person is, if you're talking about genuine insanity, is something has fucked up the internal mental map. They may not know it's fucked up. They may not even understand how it's fucked up. They may not have a good idea what their own mental map is, but they're usually, in fiction, it's usually unsatisfying if there isn't enough of a through line that a really, really savvy reader could look at them and sort of tease out what they don't know about themselves.
I completely agree with that.
Okay. And that gives you some work to some direction to work with as you explore this character.
Yeah, exactly.
Another suggestion, again, feel free to completely disregard this because our processes might be completely different. Sometimes when you've got something this sprawling, it's really useful to narrow the focus all the way down, mm-hmm. to strip away all the big ideas that you've got. Find the small story, tell the small story, and then look for ways to work the big story into it and to break it out as you go along with the actual writing, rather than trying to plan a tapestry from the beginning.
Yeah.
As a cycle writer, what I do is I tend to start with that small story, and then at certain points when things stop working, I will stop, I'll go back and I'll lay in extra threads earlier on so that they can come in, and that It results in stories that are A, much faster to write, and B, much more satisfying for my readers than the times I've tried to take a big canvas and put it all up sort of at the same time.
I think that may be the golden nugget of this particular episode, Dan. That's sage advice.
To give you some examples from my fiction, Down from 10 is a story about, and it actually says so right in the text, it's a story about sitting with Satan, the satanic character who exposes to you the things about yourself you're not willing to see. In the antithesis progression, it's a story about one guy. There's 45 main characters, but the story is about one guy who is torn between his desire to stay alive and be left alone and his sense of obligation to use his knowledge and skills to keep the rest of the solar system from falling into a war that nobody can win. The Clark Lantham books are all about Clark Lantham's conflict between wanting just to do his job and not have to think about the bigger questions of life, all of which he's failed at, and the fact that each job he comes in contact with forces him to cope with parts of his personal life that he has avoided. If you can narrow your scope down to be able to describe the main core story, even if the core story is a single thread in a big tapestry, if you can narrow it down to describe your character's main core story in one sentence like that, you've got a story that you understand well enough to write in a way that'll knock everyone's socks off.
Bam.
Already.
And let me take a chance to reiterate, every writer is so different in the way their psychology works and the way that they find a way to work. The most important thing is to discover the way that you work best. So if the shit I'm saying just confuses things, ignore me. Please.
No, you have given me quite a lot of good advice that I will definitely not be ignoring.
Awesome.
And I think also another thing to keep in mind is that they're, you know, just as writers are so diverse, so are audiences. And so you may have an audience that eats up everything that you do that, you know, doesn't like what I do.
Absolutely. So,
yeah. Which in and of itself is its own validation, really.
Right.
I mean, that's why we do this, to entertain. And if you successfully entertain a group of people, bing, win.
Absolutely. It's like yeah. Neil Gaiman was asked once how he goes about his art. And he said, wait, stop right there. I do entertainment. People 100 years from now will decide whether it was art.
Yeah, there you go. I think that kind of artistic, I don't know if it's humility, but certainly accuracy or honesty is a good way to liberate the writer to just write what you want, and don't worry about the audience, don't worry about the history staring down your back going, oh, this is crap, well you'll never last into the new millennia,
right?
Yeah, my approach is actually that I'm what I'm writing is what I would want to read, which is something that when Dan said it in an earlier part, I was laughing silently behind my muted microphone. That's exactly what my approach is. I just write the stuff that I would want to read, and I hope that there's enough other people who want to read it too and enjoy it, you know, when I actually finish it.
Which segues us gracefully into our oath that we exact from you at this point, Master Benjamin, that's if this story should ever find its way to completion and up on the Kindle ebook formats or Smashwords or hard copy, that you write us back and let us know so we can sing your praises and laud your voice and see if you listen to any damn thing we said.
I will be certain to do that. I don't know for sure that this story will ever see the light of day, but I definitely will have others that will.
Please do.
I already have one that did. It's on Amazon. It's a short story. It's called The Demons of Lushtay.
Yeah.
And it's up on Amazon for Kindle. And eventually I will expand that into other publishing mechanisms when I have these free time.
All right. Very good, gentlemen. Thank you so much. I think I don't know about anybody else, but this feels like a very productive discussion. I don't know if we achieve literary gold or not, but there's definitely been some good material out there. Brian, what do you think?
Certainly some nuggets of gold. And so, Dan, thank you very much. And Ben, I wish you best of luck, and I think it's a good story to pursue.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
It's been our pleasure, Dan. Thank you so much. All right, everyone, that wraps up this episode of the Roundtable Podcast. This will be dropping March 6th as our premiere episode, and then every week after that on Tuesday at midnight, hit your RSS feed, hit the Roundtable website at www.roundtablepodcast.com, and check for the next episode. Coming up in episode 2, we talk to Nathan Lowell and discuss the creative process with that gentleman of the potosphere. Until then, thanks for joining us. We'll see you again soon.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LeBroyer, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.